everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am here. I have a really great guest for you, and I've been wanting him to come on for a while. But as you know, I've been doing the summer series about Blonde Bombshells. And then I got like William Wellman, Eddie Muller, and Chris Costello. I have tons of people to put out still. So Howard kindly waited, and we are finally doing it tonight. And I'm speaking to Howard Johns, and we're talking about his very good book, Greed and Glamour in the Jungles of Mexico, A Stolen Paradise. And this is basically his talking about what happens when the Night of the Iguana and the Stars come to town. So welcome, Howard.
Hi, Grace. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast, True Stories from Tinseltown. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Or of Tinseltown. It is a thrill.
Well, this is a true story.
It's a I know.
This is a real true story.
That's why I have True Story of Tinseltown, because I only want true stories, although we will talk about movies and things like that, which are fake movies. But, you know, we talk about the other stuff. Tell us all why you decided to write this book.
The book is The Stolen Paradise. It's a cryptic title. But as I think we mentioned just before we started this, I wanted to write a book about the making of the movie, The Night of the Iguana, and how this all came about, just to do a little bit of backstory here. I went to Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, which is where I live now. This is where we're speaking from, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Hola.
I came down here. Yeah, hola. Hola, amiga. I came down here ostensibly to research a book about the movie, The Night of the Iguana. I thought it would be fun to do it. And I thought, I'll knock this out in about a couple of months. I think this would be easy to do. This was my original concept. I'll go back, I'll write it up, because I was living in Palm Springs at the time, and I'll get this book out, and it'll be wonderful. Right? This was my plan. But it didn't work out that way. What happened is I came down here, and I realized, oh, my goodness, I really got myself into a big project here, because there was very little information about the making of the movie. And the thing is that the original movie was made in 1963, as a lot of people will remember. It was the most publicized film of its time.
Yes.
And you remember
amazing
the circumstances of
yes.
It was a huge movie. So I thought, oh, there'll be lots of information about the movie that I can use. But lo and behold, I was in Puerto Vallarta on vacation. I went to the same places where they filmed the movie, which, of course, have long since disappeared back into the jungle.
Yes.
And there was very little information, if anything. There was very little in existence. And I thought, oh, my goodness, it was a mystery to me. So I was at that time still in California. I was coming back and forth. I thought this would be an intriguing project to write a book about the making of the movie. But as I said, it took a lot longer than I expected. But I think it turned out to be much better than if it had just been a quick little, you know, they made a movie in Puerto Vallarta and all the movie stars got drunk and everybody had sex and then they all went home, which is essentially what most
happened.
People know about the movie.
But it did happen. But there was more. And there was a lot
of
stuff.
More.
There was so much drama and intrigue and behind the scenes stuff. And it's amazing. And I love the movie. It was on the other night on TCM.
Yes.
I own the movie.
It was on.
Yes. I own the movie.
They screen it a lot. It's a very popular movie. It's been around, as you know, for all these years. What is it now? 55 years. It
Wowza.
Came out in 1964.
Right.
But
yikes.
It's a weird movie. I like the movie. I would say it's one of my favorite movies, but at the same time, there's a lot about the movie. When you watch it, you think, for example, I don't know if this occurred to you when you watched it, but it occurred to me, why is the movie in black and white? I always wondered that. That was a big question to me, and I got the answer, I think. It's in the book.
Well,
but
tell everybody.
There were a lot of,
tell people why it
well,
was in black and white.
It's funny, but there were so many movies that were made at that time, you know, in the early 60s that were in color.
Right.
John Huston could have made the film in color. He should have made the film in color. But for deeply personal reasons, the film was filmed in black and white. And when you watch it now, it probably looks a lot older and a lot less interesting visually, I mean, than a film if it had been made in color. I don't know. What do you think?
Perhaps. You know, I really like the black and white aspect of it, because I'm trying to think of, you know, the beautiful ocean and things like that. And perhaps you're looking at the scenery too much, you know, you're instead of really concentrating on the nitty gritty, because I'm sure the skies were beautiful, the, you know, the oceans there. And I don't know. I liked it. I tried to imagine it in color. I'm sure I love the movie regardless, but I do like the black and white.
Well, you know, you sound like John Huston.
Well,
he said the same thing.
Yes. Is that what he said?
Well, he said, you're paraphrasing John Huston. He said, I want the emphasis of the story on the drama. I don't want the audience watching the scenery. I want them to concentrate on the drama, what's going on between the characters.
And that's the thing
that he wanted, is he wanted the emphasis on the story. So you're probably in the 80% or 90% of the people that wanted it that way.
Yeah.
I probably am biased because I'm down here, but I got to tell you, the jungle looks beautiful in color.
I bet, but we'd be distracted. We'd be going, look at that beautiful jungle. Look at those bronzed beach boys. Look at this. Look at that. You know, you could really catch
it's possible,
that.
This is all hypothetical, Grace.
Right.
But it's possible that if the film was in color, it could have been a substantially more different film. But the reasons are explained in the book. And without getting into an enormous amount of detail about it, I think the production of the movie is in many ways just as interesting, if not more so interesting, than the movie. You've read my book, so you know the things that I'm talking about. I don't think I answered your question properly. You asked me why did I write the book. Well, the thing is, when I came down here, I was so excited to visit the movie locations where the film was made. You know, most of it was shot in Puerto Vallarta, actually about 8 miles down the road. It was shot at a little beach called Mismaloya.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a lot of studio work. Most people don't know this.
Mm-mm.
But there was a lot of studio work done and a lot of location work done in Mexico City. And the production of the movie actually began a long time before that. They started the pre-production of the movie out of Hollywood. But at the time, as you know, back in 1963, they had just released Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
Cleopatra was the big epic, as you know, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. That was the biggest movie of the decade.
And the biggest bomb. The biggest bomb.
Well, I don't,
and financial losses, so? They got a lot of money. Yes. They lost a lot of money. It went over time. It
cost
went
a lot
over,
of money.
Yes.
Cost a lot of money.
And I don't think they really recovered it.
No. Well, it almost put 20th Century Fox,
right,
you know, underground. It really,
yes,
almost buried the company. You know that.
Yes.
That's part of Hollywood history. But all that was very much at the forefront when Night of the Iguana was going into production. We should probably go back a little bit earlier than that, because it started its life as a play.
Yes, I would love to discuss that, because yeah, Betty Davis was in that play. Also, you know who I interviewed? I interviewed Lane Bradbury, who played the Sue Lyon part. I love Lane. Mm-hmm. She is so good and fabulous. And she also
She was in the part played by Sue Lyon in the movie.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she said Betty was, you know, not nice. That was her thing. She said she just didn't bother with her. You know, kind of like,
oh wow,
you know.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yes,
you know, the life of the movie really it owes a great deal to the play. There are substantial differences between the play, but if it wasn't for Tennessee Williams,
yes, we've got to get his name in there. He wrote the play. Yes,
yeah, we've got to give thanks to Tennessee Williams. He is the man who created Night of the Iguana,
mm-hmm,
and without him, there'd be no movie, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the play was written almost, it was in his mind 20 years before it premiered on Broadway. It was the longest gestation of a play ever written by Tennessee Williams. He started writing it in the 40s when he came down to Acapulco. He went to Acapulco. He spent a lot of time in Mexico as a young man. And when he wrote The Night of the Iguana, originally it was a short story. Then he expanded it into what he thought would be a novel. It became a play, but it was a very difficult play for him to write. I think it was probably one of his most personal plays. Out of all the plays he wrote, and he wrote a lot of good plays, but he probably put more of his real emotion in that play, in Night of the Iguana. It's a terrific play. So the words of these characters are great.
Yes.
Do you agree or not?
I have never read the book, nor did I ever see the play. And I know the play ended, and the book ended quite differently than the movie. And that was a bit of a brouhaha because the play ends much darker than the film.
Well, all of Tennessee's plays were pretty dark. I mean, yes. He was a dark person, wasn't he? He was a very, very tormented person. I love his work, by the way. I love his plays. I love Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is one of my favorite Tennessee Williams works. I like A Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, my God. I just saw that the other night again. And
isn't it great?
Oh, Vivian Lee is amazing. All of them. Kim Hunter and Marlon. I mean, what a great film. But I got to give props to Vivian. There is no way that Jessica Tandy could have turned that. You know, she was great on stage. I didn't see her on stage. I wasn't born. But
no, of course.
You know, Vivian.
Jessica Tandy was one of these people. Another actress that comes to mind or springs to mind would be, oh my goodness, here we are. I'm usually so quick to remember names. But Geraldine Page.
Yes.
A great stage actress. She
very quirky.
Few films.
Very quirky.
Yeah, they didn't photograph very well. Jessica was very bird-like, and she didn't she wasn't a very, I want to say she wasn't very photogenic, but you understand what I mean. Uh-huh. She wasn't a classic beauty.
Nor was Geraldine, so I get what you're saying, yes.
No. And mm-hmm. the same with Gwen Verdon, the dancer who did the original Sweet Charity. So when Hollywood came along and started casting a lot of these plays and turning them into movies, it was quite common for them to pass over the star of the actual play in favor of a movie star in Hollywood that, you know, that had nothing to do with the play. But anyway, that's the way Hollywood works, still works that way. But The Night of the Iguana certainly was very important because it was the very last of the great Tennessee Williams plays. He poured his heart into that play so much that I think he just ran out of emotion. He never quite recovered from that play.
Well,
it was a big success, but it was the end of the Tennessee Williams.
His run. How old was Tennessee Williams when he wrote The Night of the Iguana?
How old was he?
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
General.
He would have been, well, 40. He was in his 40s.
Yes, and also during that, he was losing his partner of many years of dying of cancer, mm-hmm. and
right.
but he had, you know, met a young, handsome buck who was his pal, and he was there while his friend was dying of cancer. He had been with him and depended on him, so I'm sure that was a very dark part of his life as well. I mean, it's not fun watching your partner dying of cancer who's living in your home,
no.
so... He was going
all this
through
happened,
mm-hmm.
All this happened at the time that the play was being produced. Now,
yes.
Let's put this into a context. It was happening in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
The play opened in 1961. It was voted the best play of the year by the New York critics
right.
in 1962, you remember. And the star of the play was, you tell me, you remember.
Betty Davis.
Betty Davis. How many people remember that? It's amazing. She had nothing to do with the movie, but she starred as Maxine.
Well, I was pretty surprised. I was surprised because I didn't know that, you know, and as I delve into more and more stories and people and stories I want to talk about on the podcast, I found out that she was Maxine and I saw her outfit and, you know, her whole thing. And, she was in it. And it was who? Margaret Leighton? Also?
Margaret Leighton, a British actress that a lot of people don't remember anymore, but she was a stage actress. And I got to also add that Betty Davis was a stage actress. She was a stage actress before she was a film actress.
Right.
And she would go back periodically to the stage. And at the time that Night of the Iguana was being made, there was an attempt, a real attempt on Betty's part, because her career, her movie career, had kind of stalled and then started to slide down a bit. She was doing television parts. Her career wasn't what it was 10 years before when she did All About Eve. So she wanted to do The Night of the Iguana.
I think her intentions were honorable. She saw it as a comeback. She knew it was Tennessee Williams. So she was in it for all the right reasons. But everything happened for the wrong reasons. She wasn't very happy with the play, and she ended up leaving the play. But she was in the play when it opened, and it got a tremendous amount of publicity because it was Bette Davis. You know, everybody went to see The Night of the Iguana. Then it won the Best Play of the Year. And Ray Stark, the movie producer, was one of the partners in Seven Arts Productions, which was a movie company that also produced plays on Broadway. And one of those plays that Ray Stark was doing at the same time that Night of the Iguana was being staged, he was developing the play, the musical play, Funny Girl, which was about to open on Broadway.
Wow.
And Ray Stark had a huge role in the production of The Night of the Iguana. And the more I found out about this movie, the more I realized it was a big story and nobody had written about this, you know? And I thought, my gosh, I got to do it.
I couldn't wait.
I didn't know if I was up to it.
You,
but I said I got it.
You were, and I enjoyed it so much. And I know that you, because I go on the author's page, Classic Hollywood author's page, and that's where I saw that you were going to write your book and it was going to come out. And I was like, I can't wait. And I went to Amazon. I looked it up. It hadn't been released yet. And I couldn't wait to read it because I love The Night of the Iguana and all the drama behind it, which we will get into, and all the players, basically. You know, they were so interesting, and their stories were so interesting, and what was going on in their lives at the time was pretty fascinating. And so did they ever consider Bette to be Maxine in the film?
Well, we've got to remember that before we talk about Ava Gardner, you know, nobody was thinking of Ava Gardner. Nobody was thinking about Deborah Carr and all these people because, of course, they were concentrating on the play. But one of the things that I found very interesting, Grace, was when I was researching all this, how much input, how much involvement Ray Stark had personally in the movie. Seven Arts had put money into the play, so they basically, by default, they owned the rights because they invested in the play. They owned the film rights to Night of the Iguana. So now Ray went about putting together a cast, which he was looking for a dream cast, like every producer wants the perfect cast that will bring in an audience. Because when you take a Broadway play that has a limited run at a theater with 1,000 seats, and then you turn it into a movie that basically is going to play at cinemas all over the United States and hopefully make millions of dollars, you have to make considerations, and that brings about changes, as you know, to how films are made, because you're trying to bring in a mass audience. So Ray Stark was actively soliciting actors for the film that would make people say, oh, I want to go see the movie, you know. So Bette Davis had left the play. Basically, she left the play halfway through the run, and her part, the Maxine part that she was playing in the play, was taken over by Shelley Winters, you know?
Uh-huh.
So Shelley Winters came in and took over the part for the rest of the play, and then basically the play closed. So while all this backstage drama was going on, Ray Stark called John Huston, who had just done a film before this for Seven Arts Productions. The film was, as you know, The Misfits.
Marilyn's last film and Clark's last film and, yes, heavy-duty movie.
A terrific movie that also bombed. Nobody particularly liked it, but it's a great movie, but very dark. It's a very dark film written by...
And then you know what happened after. You know, I think that part of it is the knowledge of the making, because there's a lot about the making of The Misfits. And, you know, Arthur Miller, Marilyn, and Clark Gable, and waiting on her, and the heat, and all that stuff. And, there's a lot. And poor Monty Clift, Marilyn said, he's the only person I know who's worse off than I am. Poor Montgomery. So
that's right.
So I didn't know he had a hand in that as well. That guy.
Well, it's an interesting story because it keeps digressing, but it comes back to the point that nothing happens in a vacuum, as we know. Everything is relative. Uh-huh. But while Night of the Iguana was being put on the stage and then being adapted as a film, there were other things going on at the same time. So we have to remember that. And that was one of my jobs as a writer, was to put it into perspective. Because a lot of people who are watching movies on Turner Classic Movies, and a lot of people who are watching Netflix, for example, or streaming films, weren't born in 1964. You know, they didn't exist at that time. So
right.
they're looking at everything through a prism. You know, they're looking at it through a looking glass. They weren't living it. There's a bit of a difference. And I wanted to bring to life, to the best of my ability, because I was a baby at the time, but I wanted to bring to life the milieu, the actual color and the excitement of this movie being produced during Cleopatra, which had just come out, and all the excitement and brouhaha that was going on about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, because it was a real Hollywood circus.
It was unbelievable, yes. And they had made the VIPs together, but it hadn't been released yet, right? That was the second film they did together prior to Night of the Iguana. They didn't work together.
And all this was,
yeah, go ahead.
No, this is all happening around 1962/1963.
Right.
Right. So this is when you were talking about the VIPs. Well, that was all in the can at the time that Iguana was being put on the screen. However, Cleopatra was just basically going into its roadshow release. It had opened in big cities, and then they took it on the road, literally. And this film went around the world. So by the time they actually got to Mexico, Cleopatra was just opening here. It was just opening in Mexico. And it had the same effect here that it had everywhere. I mean, people were excited about the actors. They were curious about the movie, whether they went to see it or they didn't. The point is that the movie got an enormous amount of publicity because of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton's love affair.
La Scandale. Yes, remember that.
La Scandale.
Yes, and the Pope even condemned them. Everybody condemned them. Elizabeth Taylor. They just
We should also mention poor Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher, because they were all mixed up in this.
Well,
too.
Debbie wasn't anymore, because Eddie had left Debbie and married, and poor Sybil Burton was messed up in it, because Richard was married to Sybil, and Elizabeth was pretty harsh to Eddie to dump him during that time. But it brought a lot. I mean, I think more than anything, people were into seeing how their love developed and seeing that relationship, because it had gotten so much press, so much, you know, scandal sheet stuff, that's why people wanted to see Cleopatra.
This stuff was in the news. I have to say, you know, again, we've got to remember this is over 56 years ago. Uh-huh. But we've got to remember that this stuff was on the news every day for 2 years. It wasn't just 1 week. This was front page news internationally for 2 years. It pushed, Khrushchev, and it pushed the rocket, space exploration program. It pushed all these people off the front page of the newspapers. Politics actually became secondary, which is hard to believe today.
Really?
But politics became of secondary importance.
Yeah. But
that's how big it was.
It was
the
huge
scandal of Burton and Taylor. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yes, and I think whoever chose, I love Richard Burton. I think he's a really wonderful actor. I know he gets a lot of slack because he married Elizabeth, and they said that he wasted his talents. But I still enjoyed a lot of the work he did. And
I think he's a good actor. I think a lot of people don't get him because he's very Welsh. You know, he's a very Welsh, dark, brooding.
Did you read his diaries? Yikes. Mm.
Oh, yes. I have the diaries. They're wonderful, wonderful. A lot of the diaries were written in Puerto Vallarta, you know. And
really?
That's one of the reasons I read it. Oh, yeah. Well, they lived here for 10 years.
Yes. After.
And then after they divorced, they lived here separately.
He got a place for that other wife, right? That Susie Hunt lady.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, so let's get back to The Iguana and your book and the casting. So they get Richard.
Well, first of all, let me back up and say, Ray Stark, we got off the track, but Ray Stark, once you get me started,
I have to stay on point. I'm sorry. That's my fault.
No, that's okay. Well, we're having fun. Ray Stark was looking around the cast, big actors. Here's some of the actors he wanted. Here we go. Kirk Douglas for the Richard Burton part. He wanted Marlon Brando. He wanted William Holden. He wanted Paul Newman, Cliff Robertson. All these names were all mentioned and floated around as possible contenders to play the Reverend T. Lawrence Shannon, the starring role. But right. John Huston said no. He said, I don't want these people. You know, John was very difficult to deal with. And he and Ray had a mutual respect, but they didn't particularly like each other.
Right.
You know, that's Hollywood.
Yeah, it is. So, you can work together even if you hate each other, that's pretty good. Yeah.
Now, I should also mention, I want to keep on point too, but I want to mention that Tennessee Williams had approval. Aha. The Tennessee didn't just sell the rights to his plays. He had an active participation in the making of the films.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether it extended all the way down to casting approval, I'm not exactly 100% sure, but he certainly had script approval, and he had a certain amount of creative input. So a lot of this had to go through, you know, Tennessee Williams for approval, because he had, you know, his name on it, and everybody had to consult him. Ray Stark wanted to make a movie that would bring in a huge audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Richard Burton was the first choice. Ray Stark was looking for actors that would be box office, like Sean Connery, for example, would have been a terrific Shannon. But I don't think Sean Connery was mentioned. But I think looking back, he would have been great. And of course, he wasn't going to do that. He was doing James Bond at the time. However, because of all the Cleopatra publicity,
mm-hmm.
I think Ray Stark looked at Elizabeth and said, you know what, she's getting a lot of publicity. Let's see if we can get Burton. And I think that's how Ray Stark approached the casting of the movie. It wasn't necessarily about, is Richard Burton the best actor for this role? If you know what I mean. I think it was all about, will Richard get us publicity for the movie?
Right. And people will be curious. And I happen to think he did a really good job as Shannon. I can't see anybody else in the role. I really bought him as that tortured, drunkard, ex-defrocked priest. I bought him 100% as that, and I really liked him. And
you remember in the book, I talk about all this. I talk about them going to meet Richard Burton, who was living in Switzerland. I talk about them going to see Deborah Carr in London.
Right.
And then they went to see Ava Gardner in Spain. I mean, this was not an easy movie to make. They had to fly all over the place and talk to these people. This is in the days, Grace, when you went and had lunch with actors. You didn't talk to their agents. You went to see the actor.
How nice. How civilized, right?
Very civilized.
Yes.
You'd fly in and go to their Swiss chalet, you know.
Yeah.
You'd actually go to the Dorchester Hotel in London. I mean, it was very civilized.
And they're not on their cell phones texting other people, so that's even better.
None of that. No. No, it's amazing. And I tried to recreate it. I really wanted to give you a sense of that.
Very fun. And you get the sense of the whole thing. You did a really good job on all of this. And they really went hard. They really, it wasn't just some fluky casting. He was really looking specifically for all sorts of types of actors.
Right. So, well, Stark certainly wanted a movie that was going to be successful. He was
correct.
A very smart guy. A lot of people called him he was a producer with a certain amount of influence in Hollywood that was feared, and he was loathed, and everybody, you know, talks very badly about him. But he had a job to do, and his name was on the production,
mm-hmm.
and he was raising the money, and he was producing these movies, and he wanted movies that were going to be successful. So part of his decisions were artistic, but a lot of them were commercial, but they were for the right reasons.
I agree.
It's important to say that.
And then they get, they have to cast the little Charlotte girl. And who do they pick but Lolita, mm-hmm. Sue Lyon, who I think that was a wonderful choice.
Well, she had just made Lolita
mm-hmm.
just before that, you remember?
Right.
So that was probably an easy decision, because she was big box office. And
mm-hmm.
and at the time, Lolita was a huge movie.
Mm-hmm.
But she was in that transition period when she was just just entering puberty.
She was a budding young actress. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't think John Huston cared one way or the other. John was very ambivalent. Some of his decisions were very personal, and then other things he would let it happen. He would say, "Well, whatever you want, honey." You know, he was very much of that type of character. He would get passionate. For example, when they were talking about making the movie, the play was set in Acapulco. Puerto Vallarta had nothing to do with the Night of the Iguana. It was John Huston who went to Ray Stark and said, "I want to make the movie in Puerto Vallarta." That was his contribution. Otherwise, it would have been filmed in Acapulco,
which had already been touristed up.
And we're talking about Acapulco, where Elizabeth Taylor got married to Mike Todd, and where Lana Turner was having her affair with
Johnny Stompanato.
Lex Barker and Johnny Stompanato and Frank Sinatra and all of these people. That's where all the rich people went. They went to Acapulco in those days. You know, that was the glamorous
movie star romp. Yes.
Yeah. So Acapulco was very, very popular, and that was probably one of the reasons John Huston didn't want to make the movie there. You know, he had his own reasons for doing it here. And at the time that they were discussing the movie, Puerto Vallarta did not exist outside of a very small group of rich, eccentric people that went on vacation. You either came down here on your yacht, or you went to Mexico City and flew from Mexico City to Guadalajara, and from Guadalajara you came down through the mountains for about 6 or 8 hours by jeep to get to Puerto Vallarta. It wasn't an easy place to get to, you know, at that time.
Right.
And so you really wanted to come here. If you were coming here, you had a reason. And a lot of people like Rock Hudson, who's in the book as well. Rock Hudson was here for his personal reasons, because he liked Mexicans and he liked to disappear. And Elizabeth Taylor and all these people were all attracted to this place because it was very much a place that was off the map. You know, it was off the beaten track. And it would take a lot of work to find you if you came down here in 1963. It wasn't like it is now.
Right. And prior to the Night of the Iguana. Yes.
Yeah. So before the Iguana was filmed here, very few people had been here and very few people even knew about Puerto Vallarta. It was not anything like it is today. We have the movie and we have John Huston and Ray Stark to thank or to blame for this, because they are the people who were directly responsible for putting Puerto Vallarta on the map. Otherwise, it's debatable if it even would exist as a tourist resort. But it's possible someone else would have done
it. I think somebody else would have developed it, because let's face it, this is the way the world is. They're going to turn the Bronx into Manhattan number two one of these days because they're running out of space. And I don't know how anyone can live anywhere, but that's what they're doing. So people
will
develop.
But I do make the point in the book, and I make a very important comment, mm-hmm. and that is that many movies were filmed on location in different cities in the world. We can think of lots and lots of places: Rome, Paris, London, New York, and many, many other places besides those. But the movies did nothing to change those cities or those towns. I think The Night of the Iguana is the only movie, I can't think of another one, Grace, that actually is a movie that changed a city.
And made it a touristy joint. And, I agree with you. I can't think of one either, but I'd have to really set out to think of one, but I don't have time to think of one. And I think you're correct. Yes.
But I think it's important, because that also gives the film a certain, if you like, a certain currency or a certain value that normally wouldn't exist. I mean, it's followed the movie around all these years, because when you say The Night of the Iguana, inevitably you say Puerto Vallarta. It comes out in the same sentence, you know?
Yes.
And I don't even know if the cast members, talking about the actors, I don't even know what they must have thought at the time. I know they had a certain hesitation, a certain reluctance to come here, because it was in the middle of the jungle, and it wasn't a place that had 4-star resorts and, you know, chauffeur-driven limousines and air conditioning and all the things that movie stars were used to.
Right.
They were coming to a place that had nothing. Nothing.
Very remote.
Really. It was a big job on John Huston's part to convince these people. And that tells you what a great seducer and a great person he was in the ability that he brought to directing, that he could convince people to do things that they probably shouldn't have done.
Well, it seemed that Deborah Kerr was pretty go ahead with it, Deborah. And Ava had worked with John how many times? Two other times prior, right? I think.
Yes, that's true. And, well, if you notice, there's a relationship between John Houston and most of these people which you're talking about. They certainly were friends or they were foes.
Right.
Not necessarily in that order. But they were certainly people that had crossed paths with John Houston before, whether they worked with him or they were just friends socially.
Or just knew of him.
His movies.
Right.
Absolutely. He worked within a very, very small group. The person he did not know, of course, was Richard. Richard was the outsider. But by virtue of his relationship to Elizabeth, I also must mention that they were still not married. This
yes.
scandal was the same when they were making the Night of the Iguana.
Right.
This scandal was at fever pitch.
Yes, because
that's when the Roman Church was condemning them.
Well, wasn't that Eddie was not going to give in. Eddie did not want to sign away for the divorce. And I know Sybil was not doing the divorce yet, but I think she wasn't being as stubborn as Eddie was. I think that he
right.
was kind of holding him back and whatever, you know.
Well,
he was
there were children involved. I mean, there were two marriages. There was the Sybil Burton, Richard Burton marriage. There was the Elizabeth Taylor, Eddie Fisher marriage. I mean, all these people were essentially breaking the law at that time. You know, they were cohabiting. They were adulterers, essentially, which is what the church considered it. They were committing adultery.
And what's bad was they were committing it in public because a lot of people committed yeah. adultery, but they were not big-time movie stars, and they did not
right.
have paparazzi after them and get shot after shot. They were just committing. And Elizabeth was already, you know, not thought of well because she, you know, took Eddie from Debbie. So then she goes and takes Richard from Sybil. So
it's like an Aaron Spelling soap opera.
Really should have been. It really that would be a riot. It would be perfect. It would just be perfect.
But I tried to include all this again for that reason that I thought, you know, we've got to remember that all this was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, you did have a lot of stuff happening, and I'm amazed they were able to make a good movie because it could have been a disaster.
Yes.
Really, all things considered.
So let's get back just the casting. They cast the fabulous Grayson Hall as, what was her name? She was fab. And she got nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for her part as Charlotte.
Her character's
Scott.
Name is
Miss Fellows.
Plays a character, Judith Fellows.
Yes. Fellows.
Am I spoiling the drama if I tell people that she's a lesbian? is that a problem?
This is the whole thing that it is alluded to, and then Burton as Shannon has a little bit of sympathy for her and says, "Stop it, Maxine." I don't even think she knows it herself. You know, she's one of
well,
these.
Well, there's a lot of sexual. There's a lot of sexual ambiguity in,
yes.
In the movie because you've got Shannon, who is portrayed as a pedophile, essentially chasing after this, lusting after this teenage girl, which
who
is also illegal.
Lusting after him.
Who is supposed? Well, that's to give it some sort of parallel. I don't. It's all very, very murky. And then you've got the lesbian influence. You know, is she or isn't she? And she's after poor Sue Lyon, and then you've got Ava Gardner after her Beach Boys, but she's also attracted to
Shannon.
Richard,
yes.
to Shannon. And then you've got Deborah Carr, who's probably the perfect match for Richard. That's a nice love story that at the end they turn it around and surprise you because she leads. It's a very, very adult, serious story. It's not a frivolous
not in
love
least.
Story.
And there's
it's
Nano.
Very, very good.
Nano,
yeah.
that actor. I've seen him in so many things, and he seems like he's 200 years old. You know, you just like think he's going to fall over and die any minute.
Oh, we're talking about Cyril Delavante,
right?
Who plays the poet? Yeah.
Yes, her Nano,
right?
The guy. And Deborah plays, she's sort of a grifter, actually. She sells pictures. She doesn't have any money when she comes to the hotel, but he's tired. And Ava just like says, okay, you can spend.
Who do you like the most? Is there one character or one actor or actress in the movie that really stands out? What is your choice?
I like Ava. I like Deborah Kerr was very good, and I really liked Grayson Hall. I thought she did a great job. And she, if any of you guys are Dark Shadows watchers, she was on for years. She played Dr. Julia Hoffman, who had the hots for Barnabas Collins, the vampire. So that was really her only movie gig she got. And I read that Richard Burton had mad respect for her because she was a stage actress. And I also read Ava Gardner thought she was great because the woman who was her assistant, Renee, was that her name? She wrote a book.
We're talking about Renee Jordan was a black woman.
Yes, she wrote a book about
Ava
it.
For a long time.
Yes. Yeah. And she has a little bit on the night of the iguana, and she said it was a very happy experience for Ava. But it's sort of sad when you think about it. So they all come together, and there's all the – how – why don't you tell everybody about Richard and Elizabeth landing and the pandemonium that ensued with them coming into Puerto Vallarta?
Okay, well, let's pick up where we were leaving off with the casting. The casting was a joint decision by Ray Stark and John Huston.
Right.
They pretty much cast the movie in Hollywood, London, Madrid, and Geneva, Switzerland. It was an international casting of this movie. And once they got everybody on board, it was relatively easy because everybody had tremendous admiration and respect for John Huston at the time. And he had just done The Misfits, of course, and actors really enjoyed him. So it wasn't a big deal. They got good people. They got people they wanted. And the company was brought down to Mexico City.
Right.
That's where the production actually started. So everybody flew in from places like Canada, New York, and Los Angeles. They flew in on various commercial flights. As they were landing in Mexico City, they were being pursued by the paparazzi, of course, who were after Elizabeth and Richard. So wherever Burton and Taylor went, you had armies of photographers and journalists very close behind. So right from the beginning, I think John Huston was somewhat agitated, if you like, or a little bit frustrated by the fact that every time he did something, he would see paparazzi, you know, standing around. But that was also Ray Stark's wish. He wanted this film to receive an enormous amount of publicity, and it got it from the moment the film started production, you know. The press and the media were on top of it. It's not like movies now where all the hype starts after the movie's made. This film was being made, and at the same time they were filming it, the paparazzi was literally, you know, in some cases, climbing trees.
To get photos.
Following them down the street, you know, all that stuff. Which is a lot of fun to write about, I got to tell you, because you don't see that sort of thing anymore.
No, social media. Like, people have their own phone cameras. They're taking pictures. They're the paparazzi.
Yeah, I mean, there's no glamour to taking a photo on your cell phone anymore. Come on, that's not Hollywood. I agree with you.
That's just not my thing either. But I'm just saying it's all different. Social media. There's like 10 million people who do gossip on the web or on YouTube or anywhere. So it was a whole different time. And
everybody now is a movie star. You're a movie star the minute you take a selfie and upload a photo. Now you basically become your own celebrity.
Yes, I guess.
It's not like it used to be. It's a whole different ballgame.
It sure is.
But that is an example of how things change. But when they were making the movie and all the stars were coming into Mexico City, it was, I want to say, a circus, literally. It was a circus, and I recreated all this. And a lot of people would probably say, oh, this couldn't be true. It couldn't be true. Well, I got to tell you, it is true. Everything in the book happened. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you had all these things happening. So when you had the Burton and the Taylor people coming in, they brought all their kids, they brought all their animals, their secretaries.
They brought her second husband, Michael Wilding.
even Michael Wilding was here.
What was he, Richard's press agent or personal assistant?
Press agents. And yeah. They had hairdressers and valets. And
yes.
Oh, my goodness. It was amazing. So they came down. Then Ava Gardner came in, and she was very, very difficult. I got to tell you, she was the most difficult. I think out of all the people, she was probably the most vulnerable. She had just broken up with Frank Sinatra, who she divorced about 5 years before. Yep.
She was alone. I mean, she was right.
Yes.
She really, everybody she had somebody with them. Richard had
Not
Elizabeth.
Ava.
Deborah had her husband. And I guess Ava and Peter had a kind of a fling prior to that. Ava.
Well, we're talking about Peter Viertel, who was married to Deborah.
Deborah.
But had been Ava Gardner's lover prior
yes.
to this.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very interesting.
Very. It's all like, like third cousin, second cousin
course,
kind of thing. Yeah.
I got to tell you, this is also very strange. John Huston was crazy about Ava Gardner. I would go so far as to say he was in love with her.
I would
he
believe
carried a
that.
Torch with her.
And
yeah,
didn't people absolutely. Think that he favored her during the filming?
He and Ava had a relationship that went back to The Killers, remember? The
mm-hmm.
Killers with
yes.
Bill Lancaster, which he co-wrote that with Peter Viertel. So even John had a relationship with Peter Viertel. It's very interesting. This whole production was incestuous.
Yes, that's what I mean about
everybody.
Second cousins and third cousins and
yes.
that. It's very incestuous.
Everybody had slept with each other, but maybe not directly, indirectly.
Right. Sue Lyon had somebody. She had her boyfriend. That guy who was a bus driver.
She had a boyfriend.
Had just...
Yeah. She was going through teenage angst, so all that stuff was happening. Deborah brought Peter Viertel down. Deborah was probably the most well-balanced of all of them.
Definitely.
She was the most well-behaved.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And then even the guy, James Ward, is that his name, who was the truck driver?
James Ward, Skip Ward is how most people remember him. He was that blonde, kind of surfer-looking guy. He wasn't a big star.
Not at all.
But he was popular for 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, he was somebody that made a little bit of a splash, and then he disappeared. He was always in movies and television shows, but he didn't have big parts. I think this was the biggest thing, probably the biggest part he ever had was the bus driver. He played Hank.
The bus driver. You know what intrigued me about him was that he was divorcing his wife, and who was his wife? Michelle Triola?
Triola. Mm-hmm.
And she
Correct.
Is the woman she was with Lee Marvin for years. And the word palimony first started because she sued him saying that she was basically common law wife, that he was going to take care of her. And she sued right. him and it became palimony.
Correct. Very good.
Thank you. Bing, ding, 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 ding. Thank you.
You win first prize.
Yay. Yeah.
But this is amazing because it's all stuff that was going on at the time. So it's very interesting. Michelle Triola flew down, and she was begging, James Ward not to divorce her. And James Ward was seeing another woman. Can you imagine how much work this was to research?
Yes, John Payne and Anne Shirley's daughter.
Oh,
that's
right.
Who he was
with. Oh, you have the book there.
Huh?
You have my book there.
I don't. I remember it. I remember. I can't look up everything. I'm looking at I'm making sure that our levels are good.
Okay.
I've got this equipment next to me. I can't look up anything. I just remember that.
But this is very much when I wrote, I worked in the movie business and the television business. I was a publicist for a long time. And I think all that's helpful because when I'm writing about all these people, it was a lot of work, but I say that in a good way. But the biggest challenge as a writer for me is not necessarily to put my own voice in there. It's to give life to the characters. And every character in the book had a story. Every character had a personality that I was trying, to the best of my ability, to capture. I wanted to put it down on paper. And it's not easy to do. It really isn't.
No, it
isn't. Especially when you've got people that are so famous, because you have a responsibility to write about those people in the way that they really were.
Right, and not make stuff up, because it's easy. It's easy to make things up
right.
about people, and people do all the time, and biographers do as well. So, and people just saying things. So that's why I'm an allegedly kind of gal, but I believe everything you say because I believe it's all true. And they partied a lot. Deborah and her husband didn't really partake, but Ava and the Burtons would. And Richard, when he would want to be dry for a night, his wife would say, Elizabeth would say, oh, have a drink. You're no fun.
You know?
True. Yeah, well, geez. True. You know, so it was like four more drinks he had to drink and then he'd go in. And then they're saying, will Richard choose Sue Lyons? And Sue Lyons said, well, to be honest with you, he smelled of alcohol and BO because of, his, you know, it just reeked out of his pores because he drank so much booze. And then they said, well, Ava take him away from Lala's. I mean, it was just this, they just wanted all this scoopy stuff to handle to come, but it didn't come.
It's very true, and we also have to put it into a social context that in the 50s and 60s, people were big drinkers. They were probably bigger drinkers of cocktails and alcohol than we are today.
In the 60s as well, and smokers.
Yes. Absolutely. Big smokers, big drinkers. They weren't necessarily big drug users, although they were taking a lot of pills. The drug culture was starting to, obviously, to make itself felt. And we should go back to Tennessee Williams for a moment, because Tennessee was part of all that culture.
He showed up.
Definitely a drug user.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He was here. He came down. But he was a mess. His boyfriend, you mentioned earlier, had died. He had literally died weeks, if not a month or two prior to this. He was grieving the boyfriend. He came down to help John Huston with the script. So Tennessee was here crying on everybody's shoulders. I found Tennessee very, very difficult to write about in the book. It was a very emotional thing for me to try to capture him because he really was falling apart at the time.
Well, he had a nervous breakdown, didn't he?
He was having a nervous breakdown, right. Absolutely. And it was something that when I was writing it, I suddenly realized I didn't understand why he became such a basket case. And now I understand it was all because of the loss of his partner. And it all happened during the night of the iguana. It's amazing. So he came down and
yes.
he ended up flipping out and he left. But I had a lot of fun writing all this because I said, my gosh, this is more interesting than the movie.
Well, behind the scenes, it was pretty great. And, you know, they tried to. What I found very sad, and I think even Ava felt it was sad, is that she would, she had an affair with some 24-year-old and then he dumped her and beat her. Can you imagine taking that? You're this superstar and you meet this like kind of beach boy and everybody's warning her and he leaves her and beats her up.
She was vulnerable.
She was.
She was emotionally vulnerable.
She really had not had a long-term commitment. And did she ever, even after the 60s? I mean, she went with George C. Scott, who was married while they did the Bible, and he beat the crap out of her. And I don't think she really had anybody steady, although Frank Sinatra looked after her through until her death, that she had anybody. And she felt, I think, you know, A, she was not the beauty she used to be. She drank like a fish. And she, you know, I thought she looked lovely. I did. I didn't think she looked beautiful, but I thought I liked how she looked in this movie. She looked real and she looked her part. But she did take home strangers often, as per your book. You know, because she
wanted to be
alone.
Well, if anybody is an Ava Gardner fan, if you're listening to Grace's podcast and the Ava Gardner fan club is getting ready to start, you know, calling and threatening us, we love Ava.
I love Ava. And Ava admits this to herself. If you read Rini's book, her person's, and even Ava's, which she started with another person, Ava is not a person who shies around about what goes on in her life. She pretty much lays it on the table. And I love Ava Gardner, and she lived her life, and she said she made mistakes. Maybe she lived too hard. Maybe she didn't. But, honey, while I was doing it, it was fun. But I think at some point it stops being fun.
Well, again, you have a situation where, you know, here am I as a writer, and I'm writing about people that everybody knows.
Right.
You know, Ava Gardner. And I was trying to be fair.
You were.
But I was also trying to be honest.
Yes, and she was vulnerable about her beach scene with the boys when they're going into the ocean at night. She didn't want to be seen in a bathing suit or anything. And he said, well, just wear what you always wear, the poncho and your leggings, and you can go in and you'll be fine. But she was very vulnerable to how she appeared. She knew that, you know, she had the puffy, the eyes and this, and she was, without a doubt, one of the most beautiful actresses ever. She really was. But, you know,
when the movie was being made, we've got to remember, too, that these people that we're talking about, Ava Gardner, I think, was 41 years old. So she was all the way to 42.
Right.
Deborah Carr was in the same age bracket. Richard was probably 37. I know
yes.
he had a birthday while he was here. Elizabeth was 32. John Huston was in his 50s. I think John was 57, 58. We've got to remember these people were in their middle age at the time that they made the film. They weren't, you know, they weren't ingenues anymore.
Only Sue Lyon was the ingenue.
Only Sue.
Yeah. Right.
And look at the problem she had. She was having her mood swings, and she was having her hysteric temper tantrums because she was basically a girl.
She was
growing up. She had all the problems of childhood following her with her mother. Her mother was here. Her boyfriend was here. And she was not up to it. She was just not up to the task. I mean, she was a child actress, and she was put into a situation where she was acting with all these famous, trained actors. And I'm not saying she did a bad job, but it's a big jump to take from doing one little part in the movie, which was Lolita.
She did a huge part in a movie, Lolita.
Yeah.
She had a humongous part.
But she was the only person in the movie, with the exception of James Mason.
And Shelley Winters.
Right, and Shelley Winters. But she was in that movie. She was the center of attention. Whereas, you know, and Stanley Kubrick, you know, probably spent a lot of time with her. In Iguana, she was just part of an ensemble.
Right.
And she was, you know, she was being put out there to work with actors who were, you know, very, very, very big actors. With an enormous dramatic range.
Yes, and enormously respected by the Hollywood community.
Yeah.
Also, when we had certain things, which is the thing I'm thinking of, it's not Sue Lyon's. They did have a bar on the set, right? He took them behind the set, and he had like a little bar made for them. And he also gave them each, this is something I remember reading years ago, he gave them each gifts. And you want to tell what the gifts were? It was a very creepy gift he gave all of the cast members.
Oh, it's one of the best scenes in the book.
Yes.
It's one of the best scenes in the book. You know, Huston was a practical joker. He was a bit of a devil. In fact, I interviewed his fifth wife, Celeste Huston, and she told me, she said, you know, John was the devil. after he had his third or fourth or fifth Rob Roy to drink, he would sprout horns. She told me that. She said he was the devil. And then John retaliated when he wrote his book. He called her a crocodile. You know, oh, there was no love lost between him and Celeste.
I guess
Shane,
not. That doesn't say it.
No,
yeah.
They hated each other, you know. But the point is, John was a practical joker and had a very dark side. If you could imagine somebody playing a witch doctor or doing pagan sacrifices, it would be John Huston. I mean, he really was. He wasn't a benevolent old man with a beard.
No.
When he was making this movie. We have to remind people of this. That was later. But in the 50s and the 60s, John was still riding horses, going to bullfights, screwing around.
Well, he was very good friends with Ernest Hemingway.
Right. Very good friends with Ernest Hemingway. And he could hold his own. I mean, he could shoot a rifle. He could ride a horse, fight a bull. I mean, he was, at that point in his life, at the age of 57, 58, he was still a very virile man, you know. And we should also mention, without spoiling the fun of the book for people who haven't read it, he was also living in sin. He had taken a lover, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
So he was married to the wife, his wife, Ricky Sommer, who was the mother of their daughter, Angelica.
And his son, who was also an actor.
And his son, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't living with them. He wasn't living with them, Grace.
No.
He was living with his Egyptian princess.
And they had a child, correct?
Well, you know who it is, right?
Do
you remember?
The woman?
Annie. the woman had John's baby.
Yes.
And the baby was Danny Houston, who's now an actor and a director of his own.
I like him very much. I've seen him in some work, and I really, he's very, I like his looks too. I think he's very cute. Very different
here.
Looking.
He was a baby, but
Mere
he was here for the production.
Yes. So there was all these behind-the-scenes stuff, but he got away with that kind of thing because people weren't really interested in him and his shenanigans as much as the actors and actresses.
I haven't forgotten the question. I'm just building up to it. But here's the thing. John wanted to give everybody a really good bang, if you pardon the pun.
Right.
And he gave them these little boxes, these small little boxes, square boxes with velvet inside. And when all the cast, he gave it to Elizabeth, even though Elizabeth Taylor's not in the movie, she was on the production from beginning to end.
She was always there.
Oh, she was here, just as much as everyone else. It would have been wonderful if she had played Maxine, but I don't think Ray Starr could have afforded it.
No.
You know, because after Cleopatra, she was worth millions and millions, and there was no way that Seven Arts was going to pay that much money to Elizabeth Taylor. It would have been a different movie.
It definitely would have been. And I really I liked Ava in the role. I thought it was one of her best parts.
Yeah. I do, too. I think Ava's wonderful. So everybody's sitting around the table. You can imagine this. There's photos of it somewhere. You can probably Google it and download the photos. But there's a wonderful photo of them all sitting around this round table up at the set in Ms. Maloya down here. And John Huston passes out these little gifts, these little wooden boxes. And everybody's told, open your presents, you know.
At the same time, right?
Right, they'll open the boxes. And everybody says, what is this? And inside each of the boxes, in front of Deborah Carr and Ava Gardner and Richard and everybody, they see gold-plated Derringer pistols and bullets.
They're loaded.
The other actors on them.
Yes. How horrible.
Can you imagine?
No.
John thought it was wonderful. He was laughing and laughing and laughing, but Richard Burton was not amused.
It's rather morbid. I know that Deborah got rid of it right away, and I don't know who else, but I mean, it was, okay, John, yes. But
that's like somebody inviting you to a party, Grace, and giving you sleeping pills or a knife or something.
Thank
it's
you.
It's pretty morbid.
Yeah, it is very morbid. And
but that's John Huston's humor.
Yeah.
It's very, very morbid.
And that's, I forgot about that story until I read about that in your book. So there is
But it's a wonderful scene. It's a wonderful
it
scene.
Is.
And it just illustrates how these people were, they were functioning on a whole different level.
And it was, they were in another world for those months that they were doing this movie. And I just say everybody, you should see this movie, and Howard's book is really, really good. It is, we haven't even gotten into half the stuff that's in this book. So
that's
definitely,
it's a big story.
It's a big story, and it's a fun read. It's a juicy read, and it can be poignant in parts. It's a really good book. And if you love Night of the Iguana, read the book. And if you don't love Night of the Iguana, and you love these actors, and you like behind the scenes kind of things, still read the book. I mean, it's just a really good read. And we say, it's all true.
Yeah. Well, you're very kind to say these things. And I think it's important for people to understand, like you said, the movie exists on one level. The Night of the Iguana is a wonderful movie, and it's a good record of a Tennessee Williams play, although it's been changed a lot because that was John Huston's intention. But it's a great way to see Ava Gardner in action. She's brilliant in the movie.
She really
probably
is.
I want to say her best performance, and I know a lot of people will say, oh, that's not true, but I'd put it way up there.
I would, too.
Right,
if it's not her best. It's best of two.
Which one is her best?
I don't know. To me, this is her best. This is, to me,
oh,
I
it is? You agree?
Okay. Yeah, I do.
Her best.
Because I'm trying to think of other things she's done. But to me, I mean, she just let it all hang out. She was vulnerable. And just as she was in life, I thought she was fabulous. And I think it was her wonderful part. I thought Richard was great. Deborah was perfect in her role. Grayson Hall, loved her. And it just was a really good movie. And just as it was a good movie, it's a good book. So if you haven't seen the movie, come on.
Here's the thing. If you've seen the movie and you're curious about these people, or you've got any type of interest in Hollywood, which, of course, everyone listening to this podcast are big fans of Hollywood.
Classic Hollywood, yes.
Yeah. Here's what I want to say, though, for people listening. Very few books that you read actually get into the nitty-gritty and tell you how a movie's made. There's very few. I mean, there's lots of books written about movies, but I think one of the things, I'll toot my horn for a minute and say that
toot,
one of the
toot,
things
toot.
That I'm proud of, toot, toot, one of the things that I really am happy to share is that this book is a record. It's a printed historical record of the making of a film. So you can actually follow this through and understand how a movie is made. It just happens to be The Night of the Iguana,
right.
But it could be anything.
So that's why I said, if you're a fan of classic films and you know all these actors and you know everything and you know the directors, you can just check it out and enjoy it just in the concept that Howard is saying. And if you love the movie, it's a great companion piece to seeing, oh, this was going on and this I didn't. Who knew? We didn't
it's
know.
It's fun.
It is a fun read.
The thing I wanted to do is I wanted to make it interesting because a lot of movies I watch, you know, I'm a big movie fan.
Me too.
But what I'm doing subconsciously when I watch a movie a lot, you might do it too, I don't know, Grace, but I watch a lot of movies and I'm thinking, what's going on behind the camera?
Not while I'm watching.
What are they doing when they say cut?
What I like... I think about that after I watch the movie, and I learn about things after. But during, I just get into the movie. I don't get into the other stuff. But after, I like to read IMDb. I like to read trivia on the movies and things like that. So I really do enjoy that. And you get into this perfectly. And the name of the book, again, is Greed and Glamour in the Mexican Jungle, A Stolen Paradise. And it is by the delightful Australian, but now living in Puerto Vallarta, Howard Johns.
I'm not Mexican.
No, well, I could tell that. I could tell right off that you – do you think you don't have the accent, the Aussie accent anymore?
I don't have the accent, the hair, the eyes, the mustache, or the skin color.
No, you
totally
don't.
I'm totally Anglo-Saxon white.
Right, but it's a great
book. The title
of
the book is "It's a Stolen Paradise," and that's a little bit of a puzzle for some people. They say, "What's it all about?"
Well,
when you read the book, you'll understand.
Get it. And I highly recommend. I'm going to post this podcast, and of course, I will post the link to Howard's book, and I will also post the link to Howard's book on my page on Facebook. So you guys check it out. And this was so fun, Howard. I'm so glad we finally got to talk.
Well, we've been talking about doing this forever.
I know. I think I was 35 when we started, and now look at me. I'm 38. Ha ha. Yeah. So
well, I didn't give too much away. We talked a little bit about the book, but I haven't spoiled a lot of surprises.
Oh, there's a lot of great stuff in here.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff that we couldn't talk about. But if you're interested, please go and read it. It is a good book. Even if I hadn't written the book, Grace, I'd still tell you it's a good book.
It is a good book, and I'm going to toot his horn. Toot, toot. So.
Oh, you're very kind, and I thank you so much for calling all the way from New York to Mexico.
My pleasure. I knew this would be a fun show because I so loved the book, and I loved your writing in it. So, everybody, I know you'll enjoy this too. Check out the book. Thanks again to Howard Johns. And I'll be with you next time in True Stories of Tinseltown. Thank you, Howard. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye.
The club with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is me. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment. It might be a fight like you see on the screen. A swain getting slain for the love of a queen. Some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet, and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan hip hooray. The American